Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's event. My name is Josie Warden. I'm a senior researcher in the economy team here at the RSA. Right, so with that out of the way, I can get on with introducing today's guest speaker, Dr. Julia Shaw. Julia is a psychological scientist at UCL, and her work has focused on different ways of understanding criminal behaviour and memory, including some really fascinating research into false memory. She's also the co-founder of Spot, a startup that helps employees to harness to report workplace harassment and discrimination and to help employees to take action. But she's joining us today to shed some light on the most fascinating and enduring question of why people do bad things. I read Julia's latest book, Making Evil, which is released today in pretty much one sitting as I took a long train journey up to Scotland last week, and it's really fascinating, and so I'm really excited to be discussing it with you today. We're going to hear from Julia first, then I'll take some questions from me and then from the audience before we wrap up at two, and I really encourage anyone who doesn't normally ask questions at these events to give it a go today. So that's enough from me. Please join me in welcoming Julia Shaw.
Wonderful to be here. Brave to read this book on a train. There's a lot of very controversial topics in it. So I am delighted to be here today to talk about Making Evil. Effectively, my book is a manifesto against the concept of evil, and instead an exploration of why people do bad things from a scientific point of view, rather than philosophical or political or religious. I'm going to start with a little teaser video, and then we'll get into some examples.
We talk about evil a lot, and yet we don't really talk about it at all. What actually is evil? When we use terms like cheater, thief, liar, murderer, psychopath, pedophile, we've often already decided, before even trying to understand a person, that they're not really a person at all, rather some sort of monster. A monster who we should not try to empathize with, because they are beyond understanding, beyond saving. They are evil. But it's time to dissect evil. You see, our reactions to deviants may tell us less about others and more about ourselves. In 1881, philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote that thinking evil means making evil. He argued that evil is a subjective experience, not something that's inherent to a person or object or action. Taking this further, when we look at the science of evil, we find that proclivities underlying many of the things we label evil are really quite common. From neuroscience, we learn that our brains are built for sadism. From evolutionary psychology, that sometimes killing is the right thing to do. And from behavioral economics, that money changes our morality. It's time for you to explore humanity's dark side, to uncover the science of your living nightmares so that you can better understand those that you have labeled evil, but also to better understand your own sinister tendencies. Let me help you find your evil empathy.
First question, are you evil? Now, most of us probably wouldn't use the term evil to describe ourselves. I think if you do, maybe you really are? I don't know. Maybe that's the exception to the rule that there's no such thing as evil. But I think if you do use it to describe yourself, you're usually using it jokingly, right? You sort of go, oh, I'm so evil for eating a piece of chocolate cake. You don't mean it in the way that we use it when we use it when we describe other people generally. And so the phrase that I like to use here is that evil is something that other people are. And so even if you're an offender, for example, and you've committed something or a particular kind of crime that maybe the rest of us or society at large or certainly the tabloids would label evil, you probably wouldn't define yourself that way. And so I think it's a curious phenomenon that we use this label almost exclusively to define other people. And what does that mean about us? What does that mean about what does that say for the term itself? And I think the biggest thing it says is that we use the term for two reasons. We use it to other ourselves and others from us. So we use it to other individuals and say that they're so different than we are that we don't need to try to understand them. And effectively within that, what we're doing is we're attempting to and perhaps actually trying to dehumanize the other individual and set them in contrast to ourselves, who are complex and nuanced and good human beings. And the other thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to shut down a conversation. And so I find quite often when I'm in a social setting and someone drops, well, that's evil, or that person is evil, what they're trying to do is say, this is an objective phenomenon. We all agree here. This is so terrible, we don't even need to talk about it. And I think that's a hugely problematic view. I think what needs to happen when someone drops the E word is that we should really then ask, what do you mean? What do you mean when you're using that word? Because as soon as someone has to explain what it is they've used that term to describe, it often falls apart. But that's where we can start to pick at, is it aggression? Is it violence? Is it sadism? Is it something else entirely that this person is actually trying to describe? And then we can look at that phenomenon and say, how do we know and understand how that particular piece of this thing we call evil is and how it works? So, are you evil? I would argue there's no such thing, so you're in luck today. You're probably not evil, at least not in my books, no matter what you've done in your lives. I feel like particularly people who watch or attend a talk on evil might have particular proclivities that they don't like to share on a regular basis. But no topic should be taboo. Now, there's been some recent controversy around Liam Neeson saying that he had this murder fantasy, and it was specifically a very racist scenario that he was describing, and the internet absolutely freaked out and divided in some ways about whether it was okay to say out loud that someone wanted to kill someone else, especially given the racial connotations he was placing it within. And I think my interpretation of this kind of situation is maybe more nuanced than just saying it's good or bad. I think it brings up important conversation that needs to be had around issues that are systemic, like racism in our society, that we haven't eradicated, unfortunately, and we need to keep that conversation going. But the other thing is that it's one thing to talk about the issue in general, to talk about things like racism, and say we need to talk about this topic and we need to figure out how to change, not just how we talk about it, but how we deal with it structurally. It's another thing to have a really inappropriate comment that you say to a journalist out loud. It's one thing to discuss a concept, it's another thing to inappropriately say things and treat other human beings as, for example, subhuman, or to make jokes that are just, frankly, offensive. So I think that just because you're having conversations about taboo topics, and in the book, I talk about everything you can think of that is associated with the word evil, and that goes from small things like cute aggression, and I'll talk about that a bit later, that we've all felt when you see a really cute baby or a really cute animal, you just want to squeeze it. And that doesn't seem that taboo, but then I move on through things like violence, and I move up to serial killers, and what do these things have in common, and where are the lines? But I also talk about things like zoophilia and pedophilia, and I talk about terrorism, I talk about the Nazis. I mean, we have to be able to talk about these topics and to figure out what is going on when we discuss these issues and why they happen, why people do these things, but we shouldn't be allowed to just talk about them in whatever way we want. So do engage in conversation about taboo topics, but don't just be an asshole. Now, in terms of some of the examples of things that freak us out, I think there are many thoughts that we have that might scare ourselves. And they're often thoughts that we don't share with other people for fear of being judged or for fear of being called an evil empathizer. I think quite often when we express curiosity about a topic, let's say you're at a family dinner and you bring up the topic of terrorism and you float the question, who here thinks they could become a terrorist? Now, that's, I think, from a perspective-taking argument, I think that's a really interesting question. What are the kinds of factors that might lead someone to extremist behavior? But what's probably going to happen is your family is going to go, what are you saying? And they're going to try and shut down the conversation, might even accuse you of thinking these thoughts in the first place, and what are you trying to say? And they're effectively trying to shut down this attempt. They're curiosity shaming you. Don't let people curiosity shame you. And so I think in this case, what we, again, should do is talk about it. Now, one thing that you might be curiosity shamed for is if you express a desire that you've been fantasizing about murdering someone. Now, murder fantasies, it turns out, are among the most common fantasies within sort of this evil realm. More than half of the people in this room have probably at least once in their lives had a murder fantasy. You've probably fantasized about killing your boss, possibly about step-parents, especially as a teenager. That may have at one point come up. Or maybe, and this is my most common murder fantasy, is if I'm trying to work and I'm sitting on an airplane and a baby starts to cry. Dark, right? Remember, no topic is taboo. Fantasies, why do we have them is the question. And at what point should we be worried? And the answer is that murder fantasies are quite normal. Most of us, again, have them at some point. That's not the worrying piece. What's worrying, of course, is maybe if you start planning to actually go through with it, which most of us never get to. So why do we have them? Some evolutionary psychologists argue that we have murder fantasies specifically to play out these scenarios in our heads and to realize that we don't want those consequences. Obviously, we don't actually want to go through with this. And so it's adaptive to have these thoughts, to think them through, realize, and make an informed decision, this is not what I want, and effectively inhibit that kind of behavior. And so possibly having murder fantasies, and to some extent, at least for most of us, might even, on a small level, make you less likely than someone who doesn't have it to murder someone in real life. Now, it's a bit complicated because especially very planned murders, like we see on TV quite often, have a lot of planning that goes into them, and there are murder fantasies that almost necessarily go before them. But there's another thing in that, is that murder isn't like what we see on TV. Most situations aren't planned for weeks or months in advance. There's none of this meticulousness that we maybe even are drawn to on television. That's not real life most of the time. Murder happens for really banal reasons, and quite often those reasons are rather impulsive in the moment. And so we need to be careful that we're prepared, and we've thought through scenarios and hypotheticals that prepare us for potentially emotional situations where we might be likely to lash out. And so we're ready, and we know what we do or don't want to do in those scenarios, and we don't act as impulsively. Another one that we, I think, sometimes feel is that, have you ever laughed at a time when it's inappropriate to do so? So let's say someone's getting hurt, and you laugh. Or you're at a funeral and you laugh. I mean, there's lots of inappropriate situations where laughing is not okay, and yet we do it anyway. The converse of that would be crying at a wedding. Why do we cry at weddings? That seems like the opposite of what we're probably feeling. Now, the name for this kind of emotion is a dimorphous display of emotion. It's effectively your brain trying to protect itself from not overloading itself with one emotion, too much of one emotion. And so it shoots out the opposite to effectively give your brain a bit of a buffer. And so that's the idea behind these dimorphous displays. And so the creepy laugh that we often associate, again, with like horror movies, for example, the behind that is actually a much more normal tendency. And it's, again, I think it's we interpret into a situation where we see someone laughing as they hurt somebody else. We interpret that as sadism. But probably it's something else entirely. And this is where it takes us to another interesting facet, I think, is that, well, I think there's a huge popularity associated with TV shows and movies that put us in the position of a serial killer, for example, that put us in the brains and minds of someone who does terrible things. And yet, are we really empathizing with that person? Or is it that most of the time, when, again, you read the news, most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, you're probably empathizing with the victims, right? You're not really thinking about the perpetrators at all. And so this is what Baumeister refers to as the victimization gap. It's this idea that on the one hand, we've got the victim who we could see ourselves in that position much more easily because we're not evil, right? But we could be victims. And it's harder to truly empathize with and understand perpetrators. And so there's this gap in understanding, and there's also a gap in how we interpret that behavior, because normally we're taking the lens of the victims. But it is really important, I think, to occasionally at least also step into the other shoes. Not the least because I think all of us are capable of great harm. And if we don't step into those shoes, if we don't realize that that person, that perpetrator, could potentially be us, again, we're going to be hugely underprepared, and I think we're going to be worse humans. Now, what else? Everyday evil. So this takes me to a broader category. Now, every time I use the word evil, I feel like you need to put it in inverted commas. Evil. Everyday evil to me means that there are things that we do on a daily basis, or some of us do on a daily basis, that you could, on a surface level, describe as evil, or at least the underlying baby versions of bigger tendencies that might lead us to harm others more dramatically. And one of the most common of these that we do to our loved ones, to our partners, the person we possibly love most in the world, our romantic partners, usually the targets of our worst aggression, of our worst lies as well, partly because they're easy targets, they just happen to be there all the time, and partly because there's so much emotion that is bound up in that relationship. But one of the things we like to do is we like to be passive aggressive. Because what is passive aggression? Passive aggression is when you are effectively not doing something to make someone else suffer. And that can be something small, like not unloading the dishwasher. But you know that that's really going to annoy that person. And your excuse, but I didn't do anything. But you did, didn't you? And so this is where little things like this, I think, can seep into our everyday behavior. And you could argue that's a bit sadistic. That is a minor version of sadism. And so when we take things like this, like these situations, there's an experiment where people were asked at the end of the day to express their aggression towards their partner by putting pins in a voodoo doll. And the number of pins was then counted at the end of every day. And the more pins you had in, the more aggression you had towards that individual. I really like the thought of participants doing this at home. Stabbing. And they found that there are a couple correlates of aggression, but most people had at least a few aggressive thoughts towards their partner every single day. And so we need to be careful. So it's not just about having those thoughts, it's about what you do with them and how you turn those behaviors those thoughts into behaviors. One piece of advice, Valentine's Day is coming up. Chocolate is a really good protective layer between you and your loved one. Because you know the term hangry, there is in fact research that shows that you are much more likely to be aggressive, including to your partner, if you're hungry. So just eat something and then express yourself. So bring up your glucose levels. You'll be surprised what an impact that can have. Now there's another question that often comes up that neuroscientists in particular have spent a lot of time discussing. And it's this question of, are we born evil? Can we be born evil? Are you born with an evil brain? And I think that's usually the wrong question, because I think probably if we think about it, we all realize that it's not just nature or nurture. It's probably a mix of both. I think this is generally a problem when we talk about concepts related to evil, is we really like simple answers. You want someone like me to stand on a stage and say, this is what evil is. You're born with it. It's your left, whatever, the left part of your prefrontal cortex that's damaged when you're 2 years old, and that's it. And those are the evil people, and you're fine if you don't have this problem. But that's not how it works. We don't have these simple answers. And the nuance and the levels of why we do bad things are so much more interesting than these basic oversimplified answers. But there is some fascinating research on the brains of, for example, psychopaths. And in one study, Dr. Fallon was studying convicted offenders, and he was looking at brains of people who he knew were psychopaths, and he was labeling psychopath, not psychopath, comparing to controls, right? Psychopath, not psychopath. And one of them he labeled psychopath. He's definitely the brain of a psychopath, and it was his own brain. Now, for him, this was a moment of going, oh, I have a lot of questions. And so he went exploring in his own family tree and went to look to see if there were psychopaths, effectively, or murderous individuals in his past. And turns out there were. Now, I've done some digging like this. Oh, this is a fun experiment to do at home. Would recommend. The worst people in your families, try to find them. There will be some, and you will be shocked by where they're lurking, and why their family doesn't talk about them. Sometimes they're very close to home, unfortunately, and so you are very conscious of who they are. But for me, it turns out my grandfather, my biological grandfather, on my mom's side, at one point he came home, mostly a normal, pleasant man, apparently. I was very young when he passed away. And until about a year ago, I had a very positive view of my grandfather, who, again, I'd never met, but the way he was talked about was positive. Turns out that one day, my mom tells you the story almost lightly, he came back after he'd had a fight with his wife, my grandmother, and he came back so upset because he thought that she was cheating on him, which she was, came back the next day and wanted to kill the whole family. brought weapons? They had to leave on an emergency? This is my grand... No one had ever brought this up, the fact that he wanted to kill, effectively eradicate our whole bloodline. Which I find fascinating, that this is a thing that was hidden for so long from my own past, just because I didn't ask the right questions. And when I asked my mom, why didn't you tell me? You never asked. This is not a question that I thought to ask. So I think in general, ask more questions about tendencies, figure out what's lurking in your background, because I think it can make it much more easy to humanize and understand and realize that maybe our brains are also programmed a little bit at least to be, for example, psychopathic. So even the brain of a psychopath, so with Fallon, what he said is, he said, well, I've never offended, so I would label myself a pro-social psychopath. That doesn't sound like it fits together, but that's, again, the nuance of it. Even if you have a brain, even if you have a predisposition that makes you more likely to hurt others because you're less likely to empathize with them, it doesn't mean you need to act on it. There are lots of other social buffers that change the way that that can manifest and express itself. Now, another question. How much do you cost? If I were to offer to buy your left hand, how much would you sell it to me for? Would you sell it to me? What circumstances might lead you to sell it to me? Now, this seems like an abstract question, but A, it brings to mind certainly the meat market. So it brings to mind what we do with other animals. We cut them into pieces. Each piece has a known value, and you sell it. Now, with humans, it turns out we do the same. It feels like a taboo to ask this kind of question. We don't think about this as a trade-off that we're allowed to do. You can't just buy me. Of course you can buy me. You pay me a wage to work. You buy my time. You can pay me to, again, depending on the circumstances I might find myself in, you could pay me to possibly do lots of things, including sell my left arm or my right arm. I don't know. And when we talk about situations where price tags are, in fact, put on human lives and on body parts, this is something that courts have to do on a quite regular basis. If you're in an accident and you lose your right arm, what's the compensation? How much does it cost? And so it feels dirty even just thinking about this. And this is where Daniel Kahneman did a bunch of research, and Tetlock. So this is out of behavioral economics, where even the thought of doing these trade-offs is weird, but yet if we put it in other contexts, suddenly it's sanitized. If we put it within the framework of capitalism, if we put other names on it, if we call it below minimum wage labor in a foreign country, that doesn't sound nearly as bad as effectively slavery. If we call it animal torture, that sounds way worse than if we call it packaged meat or processed meat. We use labels to differentiate these things, even though, of course, the underlying consequences for the world and for ourselves are pretty much the same. So we need to be very careful with the labels we use, and again, to think about these things in a much more concrete way. Finally, when we talk about systems that can facilitate bad behavior, I think that certainly dehumanizing others is one of the slipperiest slopes towards committing atrocity. And we saw this with the way that Nazi Germany worked, that there was a huge effort to dehumanize repeatedly and regularly other individuals. We see it in political discourse today. We see immigrants referred to as cockroaches. We see xenophobia flourish. And the way that it flourishes is, again, by seeing other people not really as people at all. It's this idea that they're not like us. They're subhuman compared to me. And so it's justified for me not to give them the same rights, not to give them the same treatment. And so we need to be very careful. And so there's some Nietzsche wrote on this as well, and so have lots of survivors of the Holocaust, this idea that madness is quite ordinary in groups. And experiments like the Milgram experiment, where you increase the voltage of shock, where participants were simply told by an experimenter to keep going and to keep increasing shock voltage until they thought they had killed a participant in another room because the voltage was so high. That only required one person standing next to them saying, continue. That was it. Now, on a systemic level, of course, compliance, we know, is a powerful, powerful thing. And we need to be very, very careful not to become an accomplice just by standing idly by and going, this has nothing to do with me. And so Recognizing the fact is recognizing when things are spinning out of control and recognizing that you are probably capable of going along with the situation, even if every piece of it goes against your moral compass if you think about it. Be conscious, be aware, be vigilant. And now I look forward to talking about evil some more. I guess as a final thing, the last thing I'd like to say is, ideally, just stop using the word evil to describe humans. Instead, try to explain what it is you actually want to talk about, and then have a meaningful discussion, an in-depth discussion, about what those things actually are. Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Let's sit down. Thanks very much, Julia. I think that that final point was what I really gathered from the book, is that sense. There were things, before when I first looked at it, there were things I thought might be in there. But there's also lots of stuff that I really wasn't expecting. And I think it's the way you kind of make the connections between issues that are quite unexpected that makes you really question, like, what is it I think is evil, or what is it that I sort of see the behaviours leading to? Mm-hmm. Was that quite conscious of you trying to link different things together that aren't necessarily normally connected?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you didn't like the connections I was drawing in this talk, you're not going to like the book. I talk about a lot of very taboo, understandably, topics very close together. And I bring in things that can, I think, seem almost to, not to trivialize the issues, but to seem comparatively trivial. But that is completely intentional, because I think that the secret to understanding these extreme versions of wrongdoing that we often use the word evil to describe, I think the secret in understanding those lies in understanding our everyday behavior, lies in the sort of fundamental core human traits that we all have in us. And those manifest in different ways. And most of us, luckily, aren't serial killers. And so, but how do we get from us now, today? I presume there's someone in the room. It'd be so fascinating. Where are we?
That's very nice.
But I presume, like, how do we get from us to someone who's capable of that? And I think that pathway is what I always want to explore.
Yeah, because it can, like you say, it can be so easy to kind of see this as an other.
Yeah.
But actually, those small steps or those things that are in us that kind of highlight different behaviors are
even
really fascinating.
Even the language. I mean, in the book, I use the term, I effectively consistently use we. We, when I do thought experiments, we, when we transgress, even myself, because it's really easy for me as a writer even to say you or they. As soon as I use the word they, I have to rein it back in and go, no, us. It's all about us as a group and the shared humanity, not the differentiation.
Yeah, that kind of, yeah, realizing that we're all part of this together.
Yeah.
So I think you talk a bit about trying to understand putting yourself not in the victim's position, but in maybe the perpetrator's position, and what it is that has led to that. And I think I would maybe argue that we've got better as a society at doing that over the past few centuries, at actually trying to understand why people do these things for some crimes or from some issues, but possibly not for others. Do you think it is a kind of a continuum that we'll kind of keep, get better at understanding more why people do these, take these actions?
Hopefully. I think that certainly from a scientific point of view, there's been more and more research on sort of the fundamentals that underlie parts of evil. And so that is hopefully going to help us explore further sort of who's capable, what increases the likelihood that someone's going to act out. But the victimization differences, I feel like it's really fascinating who we choose to empathize with and when. And there's certain kinds of crimes, including rape, where, unfortunately, societally, there is still often a reluctance to take the view of the victim. And there we disproportionately take it often of the perpetrator. And so it's really interesting to see other factors that are at play that lead us to take which position we empathize with. Where are we allowed to go? And I think sometimes it's because we're scared. I think, like, with that, especially with things like rape, I mean, it's definitely an issue of, I don't want to see myself as vulnerable and being able to be a victim in this situation. And so I'm going to distance myself from this victim. And on other occasions, we distance ourselves from the perpetrator because we can't see that I could possibly be capable of this wrongdoing. But it's really, there are lots of other underlying social constructs that really influence which perspective we're taking. So
yeah.
I think even that in and of itself is fascinating, to talk about things like sexism and talk about structural problems.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I think, are there, with the taboos that are kind of remaining, that are much stronger taboos, do you think there are reasons why those have remained so tricky for us to talk about or even begin to be curious about, because it seems so wrong and so far away from what we're allowed to talk about?
Yeah, I think the epitome of that is pedophilia. So I when I was writing this book, and so this is another thing you'll notice, again, the topics, we go in and out of the dark. And so even for my own sanity, I realized very quickly when I started studying criminal psychology that you can't spend too long just thinking about the horrible things that people do. You need to come up for air from time to time. And so coming up for air is the lighter topics. And then you can dive back in and your mind is ready to engage again with difficult issues. Because these are difficult issues. I mean, that's why I wrote the book, is because I think it's really important we talk about these difficult issues. But I also don't want you to just shut down and put the book away and not read it. And so it's the same in conversation, I think. And so when I set out to write this book, I didn't set out to write a whole chapter on pedophiles. But I did in the end, because there is so much to say, because it is so villainized and so monsterized, mm-hmm. and it is so incredibly prevalent in our humanity. The fact that we don't even dare have those conversations about who might be a pedophile, how we might be able to help, God forbid we humanize pedophiles, right? How we might be able to help someone not transgress, not live out fantasies that they might have, and how we can aid someone who, frankly, didn't choose to have these sexual tendencies, I think it's absolutely crucial that we have that conversation. And it's very difficult for most people to even start that.
Yeah, how do we start to have those conversations?
I mean, one way is to read up on it, so you don't have to have a conversation with somebody else in person, because it can be awkward. And then to go in sort of saying, hey, this is one thing. I read this thing. What do you think about it?
Yeah.
And to try when people say, and I start with this as well, sort of like if you, there's a shocking amount of people, in my view, who think that we should bring back the death penalty in the UK, specifically for child sex offenders. And I think that that says a lot about how we feel about this group of individuals. And just the disambiguation of sex offender versus proclivity versus, like, there's lots of nuance in there that we just don't talk about enough.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You really unpack that and not seeing it as one thing, but what are the different areas of it? And as you say, reading about it yourself is giving the opportunity to even reflect on what you as an individual might think about these different issues, because maybe you haven't had much opportunity to do that before you even kind of start engaging with other people around things as well.
Yeah, and I think it's especially, the book came out in Germany in September, and I was worried about this chapter specifically, because I really want to make sure that the tone is right. I really want to make sure that it's still doing justice to people who may have been victims of this kind of behavior, because unfortunately that, as we know, is very prevalent as well. And I think that just talking about the issue, because it's a damage control situation, right? I mean, people are going to have this attraction, and so how do we deal with it socially to minimize the damage? And I think it's the only way we can have a constructive way forward. But I ended up getting a standing ovation twice for even talking about the issue, which to me suggests we really need to be talking about it more.
Yeah.
And I think the world, to some extent, or some parts of the world at least, are ready for that, and to bring that humanity back into a group that we just completely write off.
Yeah, because I guess you're saying about damage control, it's about that. I suppose the reason we need to talk about these things is if the effects of them, we want to limit the damage that's happening in society. Yeah. And if the way we're currently dealing with it isn't working, then maybe we need to rethink. And part of that is revisiting the discussions about these kind of big topics.
Exactly. And giving help to people who are struggling in various ways, including
sexually. I was really interested in you talk about kind of groupthink and how you talked about it just then as well, how we can perpetrate things collectively. And I'm kind of interested to know what you think about climate change as a kind of act that we are all involved in, maybe some more than others, but that sense that it almost seems victimless as well. How do we kind of reconcile something that's so massive like that, and is that kind of connected to different parts of these kind of research activities?
Yeah, I mean, the context I like to think of groupthink in related ways is, I mean, why do we eat meat? Why does anybody eat meat is a real question that we should be asking all the time. I eat meat despite considering myself a complete hypocrite, because I think animals are fantastic. And I think that torturing animals is probably not okay. And certainly definitely not okay. And the environmental implications of mass production in particular of meats, and don't kid yourselves, some of you are eating mass produced meats if they're not all cuddled animals on farms. That's not sustainable, that cannot feed a population. We know this, and yet we sit there and we argue that we either need to eat meat, or it's part of our culture, or it's something you really enjoy, bacon's the best. I mean, we have like memes about meat. And I think part of that is because we kind of know that it's problematic. We kind of know that it came from a real animal, and that we maybe wouldn't even have it in us to, in person, slaughter that animal. And so we're constantly sort of putting on band-aids and saying, no, no, but it's okay because men eat meat. Real men eat meat. It's masculine. Or it's, we need it for protein. It's not true. None of that's true. It's just us trying to sort of convince ourselves retrospectively and culturally that this is something that needs to be part of our lives. And I think it's really just rationalization of bad behavior. And I think the same thing is true for global warming and plastic use. I mean, it's a sort of, well, but I recycle. Is that really going to, is that the, I mean, that's part of a solution potentially, but ultimately it's things like regulating that we can't produce plastics in the first place, yeah. That you're not allowed to sell things that can't, that damage the environment to the extent they do now. And for me, I mean, I'm a total hypocrite. I mean, one airline flight is the equivalent of like driving a car for a year. I mean, it's, I say, oh, I don't have a car, I'm so green. No, I'm not. And so it's making sure that we're not just talking ourselves out of bad behavior and putting on band-aids. And actually, if you think something is important, thinking about how you can actually change your behavior in line with your morality.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, those the kind of the structures, the institutions and structures that sort of allow that and making things, put something in monetary terms rather than maybe yeah. emotional terms are kind of another way of allowing behaviors that are, might be problematic.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and in business settings, let's not undervalue the role of advertising and things like normalizing eating meat and other things like that. It's a very intentional, effectively psychological manipulation of how you feel about these things. That's what advertising is they're trying to sell you shit you don't need. But in terms of the, what was the other piece you were asking about?
The kind of structures and institutions that allow that. To kind of happen.
Yeah. I guess the take-home message of this part of is that we need to be careful. Yeah, and with money. We need to be careful not to put price tags on things that are effectively ethical questions. And to, because there's a price tag on something, just distance ourselves. And this is, I think, what can happen in organizations as well, is that it's easy to see people as employees as money. And so it's cost. Same thing with getting sued. If you get sued, it's this idea of, it's a cost. You're not really thinking about it in ethical terms. You're not thinking about the human beings. And we need to be very careful, and this is where Dan Ariely's work comes in, about making sure that just because there's money or a number in between, that we don't use that by accident or intentionally to dehumanize others and to forget the human beings those numbers represent. And some structures just make that much easier. And business structures often make that easier. And so again, just making sure you keep bringing back the human beings who are behind that and making it a more three-dimensional experience rather than just a number.
Yeah, great. I'm sure there are loads of questions from the audience, so I'm going to turn over those. I think, are you happy to take two at a time, or would you rather do one at a time?
One at a time.
One at a time, yeah, that's fine. So there are roving mics, so please wait for a microphone first. If I take the person in the middle here, and then at the back as well.
Thank you, hi. Thanks for such an interesting talk. I have quite a short question, but how would you define evil?
I don't think evil exists. So let's start with saying I think it's certainly a subjective concept. So I would define it as subjective. And I would argue that there are potentially meaningful definitions of evil as a subjective concept that come from, or even as a less subjective concept, that come from places like religion, where you mean something much more specific with it. But I think that, and it's actually funny you say that, I don't define evil in my book. And I specifically don't do that because there have been many books written on that particular issue, and it is a long conversation. And it's more, my preference is to look at things that we associate with that broad term, and then to pick apart what that actually is. But I guess for me, it's a rejection of that term in terms of actually meaning something. And part of the issue is that it's hard to define. And that we probably all mean slightly different things by it. But I think that it's a subjective term that we use as an expression of the worst possible opprobrium. And so it's this idea that someone isn't just very, very bad, someone is next level, someone is almost monstrous / into almost an overhuman, mythical status. And that's often where we use the label evil.
Hi. I'm looking at the barriers that people face to asking for help from a design perspective. And one of the things that I've been looking at myself is the impact of, and you've hinted at this, is systemic and generational trauma. So, for example, people who abuse children, I believe it's quite proven that a lot of them were abused as children themselves. And so how can we how can we dismantle these systems whilst watching out for the people who might transgress now, but bridging that point? Is there a point that we could come to where we can actually start dismantling these trauma patterns and coming to a place where we can have the dark thoughts and just be them dark, just have them be dark thoughts?
Yeah, it's a very good question. How do we break out of cycles and how do we make sure we don't normalize or at least create systems that encourage transgression? Interesting point, you mentioned the cycle of violence for cycle of abuse. One of the myths I most like to tear into. I think it's really problematic that, unfortunately, there continues to be almost as dogma this assumption that people who abuse children were themselves abused in childhood. The problem with that is that most people, luckily, most people who suffered from childhood sexual abuse or any kind of abuse do not go on to abuse their children, partly because they know how awful it is. And so that is not the way it goes. And I think to assume that people, effectively it places a huge burden, I think, on people who have themselves have this history of sort of wondering, oh my God, does this make me more likely to be capable of this? No, it does not. But we do see the other way around, that there is an issue with normalization, that a lot of people who do transgress in this way do have some sort of history, but it's a history of violence, actually, that's the problem. So it's a history of not understanding or having modeled for you how to appropriately deal with aggression. And so... So again, I think this is one of those burdens that a lot of people carry around with them, that is this sort of, does this make me more likely to become this horrible person who I feared as a child? And no, it does not. But you need to be careful not to model the violence and the aggressive behavior patterns that maybe your parents modeled. And that's where interventions from things like schools can help. And just having positive role models that people can see and say, oh, that's a much better behavior pattern, I should imitate that instead. But it is a difficult issue and lots of factors, including poverty, structural issues, schooling. I mean, there's lots of layers to that question that need to be addressed for that to really break a system of violence.
Okay. Go over this side. Lovely. And then at the front there as well afterwards.
Thank you very much. My name's Malcolm Dean, and I wrote about social affairs in The Guardian for 4 decades. And about 30 years ago, I was talking to the chief researcher of the Home Office about the disparity between us and America in terms of deaths or killings. And his theory was, well, it's much more difficult to kill people in England because it has to be done mostly by knives because the guns aren't available, whereas in America guns are available and it's very easy to kill people. But what would he be saying now? Alas, he's no longer alive, but... What would he be saying now with the way that we've now caught up New York, that is in London, and most of that was knives, although some of it was by guns?
So the question being whether guns are problematic in terms of, or whether they lead to an increase in murder,
mm-hmm.
and whether that relationship has been the same 30 years ago to now, is that the...
No,
the gun...
It's turned it upside down. I can't remember. Even now, there's been large numbers. We've never had so many people dying from knives.
Of knives, yeah. I mean, I think that, to the first part of that question, I absolutely think that having guns freely available is an awful idea. We absolutely need very strict gun regulation, every single country on the planet, if possible. Because it removes a filter. I mean, if you have aggressive tendencies, one of the best things you can have is a bit of time to let things cool off a little bit, or at least a difficult way to, as you said, hurt people. Like, it's much harder to hurt a lot of people, certainly, with a knife than it is with a gun, especially a semi-automatic weapon. And so the only way I think we can prevent, especially spree killing, is to regulate guns. It seems so obvious that I almost don't feel like I need to say it. I know it's not obvious to a lot of people. But in terms of knives, why has knife crime gone up? I do not have an answer to that. But I mean, humans, it's always in relation to what? I think, because there was a peak in, I believe it was the late 90s, where effectively there is the least amount of murder in the UK in a long time. So effectively there was a steady decrease, there's a steady decrease in killing, intentional killing of other individuals in the UK. And that started to recover. But the question is, how much of that is a natural fluctuation, and how much of that is due to societal issues and changes in the way that the UK works? And I think that I have no idea what the answer to that is, but in terms of people being scared and there being change, I think there's no doubt that that's happening. And racism and xenophobia and these kinds of issues can definitely make anger bubble up to the surface. And we all have knives, and so I think that that can be a link that can increase just attacks. So instability and fear. And we probably are in a time when a lot of people feel very unstable and very afraid. And hopefully that will, depending on what happens with Brexit, hopefully that will wane.
Hopefully. Okay, a few more. Oh, yeah, sorry.
I've got a short question. How do we talk about evil without other people thinking we're evil?
Do you have friends who you think would just shut down the conversation?
So I actually work in the prison system.
Ooh.
And I think my friends either think I'm obsessed with offenders or quite weirdly interested in why people do bad things and how we can change that. Uh-huh. And I often get people either shutting down and not wanting to talk about it, or thinking the former, that I have an obsession. So I'm just wondering how we like neutralize that topic as something we should interrogate.
I mean, I think just more conversation about it is one start. So almost desensitizing people to the fact that this is something we talk about as humans. I think that maybe starting with smaller questions. So again, maybe jumping in, sort of, why do people become serial killers? Maybe that's a bit much. So maybe thinking about, yeah, fantasies are smaller, or this is why I start with cute aggression in the book, things that we can all relate to that easily people will talk about, and then you can move from that into, well, what actually is aggression? Oh, what actually is, and why do we think people murder? But I think you do need a bit of a gradual easing in process for a lot of people, because it's the intuitive reaction is to go, I don't want to have this conversation, because they're hard. They're hard conversations to have. That's part of the point, right, is that it's a difficult conversation, and I think generally in life, if a conversation is difficult to have, you probably specifically need to have that conversation. There's actually a really fun Kurt Vonnegut quote in relation to that, who's a science fiction author, where effectively exactly that we need to have those conversations, that's when you know you need to talk about something, if it's really hard to say. But I think it's just stay strong, and when you bring up these conversations, if someone's willing to engage at all, just keep trying different angles, explore sort of what do you think, and you could start from sort of a, how do you feel? Everyone has feelings about ethical questions, and then see where it takes you. I think that would be my advice.
Okay, go to this side. This lady at the end there, please.
It's fascinating. I find that when I talk to friends about this, I can't always predict accurately what someone is going to say about issues. So I think that they're going to say X, and turns out they believe something completely different. And it's really fascinating to get to know people and their morality. And sometimes it faces them to have conversations and thoughts that they've never had. So a lot of us don't really know exactly how we morally feel about lots of issues. We haven't really spent the time getting to know ourselves in that way. And I think it's really fun to see people themselves go, huh. And you sort of starting an introspection process that I think is really useful and really, really fun to watch as well.
Okay, thank you for a really interesting talk. My name's Claudia Sturt, also prison service.
Ah.
So I've been a prison governor and so on. And over the last quarter of a century, I've come across an awful lot of people who would probably be easily badged as evil, or who at least have done the most wicked, damaging, harmful things to other people. But I'm very interested in your view on whether there's a distinction to be made between terrible actions that are premeditated and done as a sort of as a conscious and active choice for sort of self, you know, gratification, and terrible acts that are the result of a failure of control or impulsive actions, and whether you see any sort of moral distinction between offending where there is remorse afterwards and offending where there is an absence of remorse?
Good questions. I mean, I think that with planning and intent, intent certainly matters in my view. So it's not just a momentary loss of control. But if we, I think, again, often intent is not so far removed from the situation either. So it can be something you think of, and then 10 minutes later, you act on something, and that intent is still there, and so you still are criminally responsible as well. But I think that that feels very different, certainly, than something that was premeditated weeks ago. But in terms of self-control, I think I have a complicated relationship with how I feel about self-control, because I think that the justice system certainly expects that we have the ability to control our behavior. I think it's the most useful way of looking at the world, is that from thought to behavior, there's something in between, and that all of us as human beings have the ability to stop one going to the other. You never need to act out your thoughts. But there's lots of psychological research that shows that we often either don't engage in that step, or we don't really have as much control over it as we think we do. And so there is a lot more automatic behavior than I think we think. So I think in terms of at what point something counts as impulsive, I guess, is the question. So it still feels impulsive if within 10 minutes you make a decision and then you, I would say, almost still impulsively act on it. And it's still a failure of your decision-making process, especially if it's something you live to regret later. If you don't regret it later, now this is the sort of the remorse piece, I mean, that could just be that you're born with a brain that's not very good at empathy or very good at remorse. But it could also be that you don't understand that why that action was bad and you can't empathize or sympathize with the victim. And so that's a whole nother issue. So I don't know that I would consider one crime worse than another. I think there's more we can do with individuals who show remorse. I think there's more change that can probably happen with people who have actually less impulsivity, so probably with people who plan, because it shows that they're able to engage critically with their behavior patterns. But beyond that, I don't think I'd put them on a scale and say this one's much worse than this one. I think the outcome, certainly, if it's the same, is the harm that we should regard as harm in terms of badness of the behavior. But yeah, I think waffling a bit, but I don't think I would judge anyone as worse than somebody else just because of these factors.
Okay, Ned at the front here, please.
Thank you. My question is about radicalization.
Okay.
From Daesh to Cambridge Analytica,
mm-hmm.
or to Scientology. Okay. The big problem is that when people call the other the evil, it becomes plural, it becomes the others.
Mm-hmm.
And if Scientology names you SP, suppressive person, or if you are radicalized in one way or the other one, or Brexiteers or Ramoners or whatever,
mm-hmm.
how does society prevent this thing when a conversation that would not be acceptable to criticize somebody ad hominem becomes a class conversation? It's one part of society against the other part of society.
I mean, it's all about perspective, right? I think that the way that we group people into groups is fascinating in its own right. Astronauts, when they go into space, often talk about how when they first see Earth from a distance, they suddenly feel very connected to humans. Because it's just in this space, and this void, effectively, where there's not really very much at all, and you look down at this tiny little ball, suddenly you have this deep-rooted us. We are suddenly all human beings because it's us versus everything else. And I think it's the same in that even you as an individual can probably say, I identify, for example, I might in some situations identify most as a woman. In others, I might identify most with my academic friends. In others, I might identify most with so I'm half German, with being German or being Canadian. And I think it's always a matter of what you're currently being activated to think about. And so it's really easy to have this us versus them mentality. It's really, our brains just really love tending towards it. And it's one of the many ways our brains are cognitive misers, and we need to fight our brains and say, no, think about this. Stop for a second. And so we just need to recognize that our brains have a tendency to do this, think about it maybe from other ways of looking at it, and stop homogenizing people who are part of this others group, because who are we talking about? And so I think that's probably my answer to same with Brexiteers versus Ramoners. Finding, again, a shared humanity, I think, can make for much more meaningful conversations.
Definitely need that. I'll take two more, please. So it's at the front here. Yes. Yeah, it's just coming on your left.
Well, thank you so much for bringing a real breath of fresh air to this subject. Can I just ask, do you think there's any prospect of humanizing the justice system? Because it seems to me that society has an investment in the concept of evil. And I come from this particularly because I have also worked in prisons in a volunteer capacity. And I attended psychology talks in a prison and asked the psychologists why no uniformed officers were ever present. And they said to understand would make their work more difficult.
I'm actually about to publish a piece this week on why it's an atrocity that our men are, that our prisons are filled with men. But I have much, much more fundamental issues with prisons. In the sense that I think it's, I mean, putting humans in cages just to me does not seem like a reasonable response to really anything. And the idea that it's justice, it's depriving people of liberty because they've deprived others of their rights or liberty, kind of a crap argument. I mean, especially if you murder someone, how do you get justice? There is no justice in that sense. In most situations, you cannot. It's not, the world doesn't have a balance and you can't just bring it back into balance. It's not how this works. And so it's more about, again, damage control, but also how do we bring people back in as meaningful members of society? How do we rehabilitate? How do we re-socialize? Rather than just throwing individuals into effectively the way we also treat animals, sometimes worse than we maybe treat animals. And so I think I have fundamental issues with prisons. I also just don't think that they work very well, either as a deterrent or as a way of helping those individuals, who most of whom, of course, re-enter society at some point, to actually change and become what we would consider a more desirable type of individual. We being people outside of prisons, presumably, and even people within prisons. The other part of this is, of course, the privatization of prisons and questions around who's making money from putting people in prison and who are they putting there and why are they putting them there? And why is it, and this is the question of sort of the article that I'm writing, is why do we just accept that they're filled with men? That this is not an acceptable way of, like, that this should be a travesty, that we accept masculinity and toxic masculinity to the extent that we just assume that men are going to act out and be violent, and that we have to put them in cages to keep the rest of us safe. That is detrimental for everybody in society. And so I think that there are lots of conversations that would need to be had around how justice works and certainly how the prison system works in response to how we feel about justice.
Okay, take one
and
more.
And we definitely shouldn't get guards to not empathize with or humanize the prisoners. That's a recipe for disaster.
The gentleman's the few rows back.
Yeah. Just brings to mind the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Thank you. Yeah, I completely agree with you that evil is a fairly meaningless term, but yet you were quite happy to use the words victim and perpetrator, which I also regard as being at least very blunt labels, if not particularly understanding the relativism between them. Because although, as you said, there's no necessary link between being abused and then becoming an abuser, people do move around between those states of being victim, perpetrator, rescuer. You're unlikely to get up one day and abuse someone if you had a particularly balanced, loving childhood and a happy life. So I just wonder whether there's an argument to be said for dropping those labels as well. And also because we live in such a, I perceive to be a victim sort of focused culture at the moment. Any story seems to be told from the perspective of the victim without consideration of, well, what part might they have played in co-creating a situation, or empathy and understanding for the actions of the perpetrator.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think we should drop the terms victim and perpetrator, but I get your point that we need to be careful when we use them. And I think I strongly feel that we, certainly if you are the victim of a crime at any point, I think I would urge you to not let people talk you into the fact that this is now your identity forever. And that's true for a lot of situations. There's some situations that come to mind where that's more the case, where we also talk about survivors. I think we shouldn't give other people labels that we feel they should use, because I think it can really be detrimental to your identity as a complex human being. So we need to be very careful not to be bullied into stuff effectively. On the other hand, if those labels feel right for you, use them. With the victim perpetrator, the way that I'm using the concepts when I talk about it is exclusively situational, effectively the way that it would be used in a court of law. So someone who, A, isn't just accused of something, but someone who is quote, actually done something harmful and intentionally. And it's in that moment, so in that situation, that person is the perpetrator and that person is the victim. You're absolutely right that there's complexity to those human beings outside of that one situation, and that we need to not think that some people, again, this is the good versus bad, this idea that some people are always going to be perpetrators and some are always going to be the victims. We need to definitely move away from that dichotomy. But I think there is a place to use those terms, at the very least, to convey who's the aggressor, let's say, in a particular situation, and who's the person who that aggression is being directed towards.
Thank you. I think I'd like to kind of come back to one of the points you made in your introduction, talk about the Liam Neeson kind of conversation at the moment. It's because it feels so such a good example of how we find it difficult to have these conversations and how we probably need to have more of them. So if there's kind of one thing that you think we should go away and do as a result of this talk, what would you encourage us to do?
Apart from by the book. Don't be evil. No. Stop using the label evil to describe human beings. Have more meaningful conversations about things that are hard to talk about, and try to never dehumanize others, no matter what they've done. And try to find that humanity and an explanation instead of just othering them.
Thank you very much, Julia. Julia's going to be signing copies of her book in the foyer outside, so do stay behind if you would like to talk to her. And I'm sorry if we didn't manage to answer your question. But thank you very much for coming, and please join me in thanking Julia Shaw.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.